Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello. Hello, and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show. It is episode number 111.
111.
Which is Nelson in cricketing terms.
Oh.
it's in English cricket, it is regarded as something of an unlucky number. And there used to be an umpire called David Shepherd who used to lift his leg while it was 111 or
like
222. Yeah, he used to basically cock his leg up. Yeah, stand on one leg. Occasionally, it was a thing.
A thing, okay. In the 70s I'll leave and 80s. It there.
Anyway, welcome to the show. My name's Adrian Hobart.
My name's Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres:
thrillers,
crime,
suspense,
and mysteries. And our guest this week is the wonderful Nicole Johnston, who is a book coach, amongst other things.
She is. She's lots of things. And she's had a fascinating career as well.
Absolutely. She's writing speeches for some of the world's leading politicians.
And she's met somebody I like a lot.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
That's not Boris Johnson.
It's not Boris Johnson, but she's met him too. But no, certainly isn't Boris. Well, thank you for joining us on the show. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. And we really are very thrilled. We will get into the news in a moment. But It's a funny old week this week, I think.
In what way?
Well, we've got three boys back here.
Yes, at the moment, yes. Well, two would have been here anyway, and the third one, who is at Leeds University most of the time, has reading week.
So yeah,
he's here too.
Or indeed sleeping week, as it seems to be.
Well,
so
he did set his alarm for 9 o'clock and then promptly fell asleep. So
yeah, I mean, bless him. Anyway, he's getting proper food and no more pot noodles for a bit. Anyway.
I don't think he eats pot noodles.
Doesn't he?
No, I don't think so.
No, okay, fair enough. Well, thanks for joining us on the show, and we'll get into the news now. And what have you got?
We missed the Independent Publishers Guild Spring Conference.
Well, we didn't miss it, we just chose not to go.
Well, we were travelling anyway, travelling back from Rye in Sussex. And it seems that one of the main topics of conversation, as you can probably predict, was AI.
Artificial intelligence and its impact on publishing, yes.
Yes. So David Rowan, who is the founding editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. We spoke about Wired Magazine last week because they contacted you.
That's right, they did. And that was over the subject of
AI.
AI and narration and Faraday Voices putting a clause in there, which allowed them to give Apple access to every voice that they produced and then copy it.
Yeah, so he spoke about AI and he spoke about sort of fears of what the implications for the publishing industry. And so this sort of made my stomach flip a bit when he said it could have as big an impact on publishing as the Gutenberg Press, which we know had a rather big impact on the world of publishing. He described himself as 91% excited. You can tell he's a technical man.
Yep.
And 9% terrified by the implications.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably the other way round, I would think.
Yeah, I think you are. I think you are.
Well, I am to a great degree. As I say, I think AI could be really useful in certain ways, but I think what they're trying to do is take out the human element. And actually what you need to do is have an AI element that allows you to do the boring things quickly. That, for instance, there are lots of things that people use, and I have used Pro Writing Aid, as you have, and Grammarly and things like that, which are gradually getting better and better at sorting out your grammar, especially for people who really have no understanding of grammar.
Yeah, it's good for a beginning, isn't it? When you first have completed your manuscript, it's a good a sort of a past the post.
Where I have a limit, you know, I think what's so dangerous is that the whole point about creating art, whether it be what we do, publishing books, writing books, and indeed, you know, creating music or the visual arts, and indeed AIs are increasingly being used in terms of creating graphics and, you know, stuff for, you know, the visual arts. So I think, you know, that where you replace the human element with something that synthesizes human creation, that's where I have a problem with it. I think that if it enhances the process and speeds it up, that's fine. But as long as the human is still in control of it. But also, as a consumer, I want to know that someone actually went to some effort to produce the thing that I'm enjoying.
Yeah, and I have a similar view to you, because I think it's a fantastic opportunity for creative people to explore new things. For example, Jane Mapp, with her book cover design, she's used AI to create images. So when we said we want it to have a house that looks like, you know, we give it a specification for the house and the time of day or whatever, she's used AI to create something. I mean, she hasn't, so far, as far as I'm aware, none of our covers are generated imagery exclusively with AI, but she's had a try and shown us what the results of this. So it's, like you say, it can be a bit clunky at the moment. It's not quite refined enough.
Well, at the moment, you know, you're taking, you know, the general process of creating a cover, and I mean, obviously I don't create them, but you know, there's always some stock photo imagery, or generally speaking, involved, which we subscribe to. And so the photographer of that stock image, and indeed the agency that provides it, are getting some money toward, you know, in recompense for their efforts. And that's fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Where AIs come in. And this is the question. There is a big question over who owns the copyright of something that you put through an AI program. Is it the people who created the program, or is it the people who put the input in to suggest what it should make for you? That's another thing. That's another really very difficult issue, which a lot of lawyers are now poring over at the moment.
Yes, I tell you, if I was to be a lawyer, I would not want to be an IP lawyer, because it is a minefield.
It really is. It really is. Well, I mean, that's interesting that, you know, it's a useful perspective. And actually, I mean, one of the reasons we did go to the IPG conference is it's enormously expensive to attend.
Yeah, and it was in London as well, so we'd have to factor in travel and accommodation, all those sort of things.
You know, we are members of it as an organisation, but, you know, I do think that the price point at sometimes of their activities is beyond our means. Should we put it that way?
I think it's just that we'd rather spend that money on our books than our authors.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right.
But also at the IPG conference, Nigel Newton, the CEO of Bloomsbury, very well known.
Yes, that famous independent publisher. Yes, go on.
So he was a bit more sort of rosy about the future of AI. But one thing he talked about, which I quite like, is he talked about the publishing industry in terms of the success of smaller independent publishers. And he's saying the reason that they are a good thing to have, now this is coming from somebody who owns a large independent publisher.
Mega independent publisher.
So it still calls itself an independent publisher, but it's...
And it got 8 nominations for the IPG Awards. Yes, go on.
But it doesn't have the flexibility of smaller presses such as us, which he says is a good thing for the smaller presses. We can take greater risks. We decide what we publish. It's good authors who come to independent presses that may have a better chance because of that. Because we can.
Well, I think another point he made was that we you know, authors often have a better relationship with their publisher because it's more relatable, because you're dealing with, in our case, the two of us, as opposed to a committee. Or, you know, you might be working with one person for 6 months who can again then gets a promotion or moves to a different company and you lose that relationship. So, yeah, there is a consistency factor there.
Yeah, so it's nice to have somebody from a big company champion the likes of us, that's all.
Yeah, okay, fair enough, fair enough. The story I've got in front of me is about bookshop.org, who have made quite an impact, particularly in the United States, in supporting independent bookshops and creating new revenue streams for them. But what they're entering into, bookshop.org, is they are now moving into the e-book market, and they are planning to be selling e-books by the end of the year. And they're also going to publish their very first book, which is Our Strangers by Lydia Davis. Now, they're currently programming their shop front and selling e-books at the moment, and it's in beta testing at the moment. But their thinking is that, for instance, Lydia Davis, the author of this book, has refused to go on Amazon, to have her book on Amazon.
Mm.
And so this has prompted bookshop.org to add to their offer. And I don't know how it would work in terms of benefiting the independent bookshops if you buy an ebook from them. That isn't clear yet.
No, I don't think my impression is that it doesn't. It's separate.
Yeah.
To what they offer for independent bookshops. Now, talking about independent bookshops and bookshop.org, I have a story as well. Or were you still on your story?
Well, no. I mean, let me just add some context on that then. So, I unfortunately can't tell you who the name of this guy because the first page corrupted somewhat. But anyway, this person from bookshop bookthingy.org. My brain's gone too much. Bookshop.org. Yes, I was right. We want to give independent bookstores a way to sell ebooks and capture those sales that they are losing to Amazon. So it is actually, and this was a speech made at the American Booksellers Association Winter Institute in Seattle. Bookshop.org already has strong ties with the independent bookselling community. And beginning on March the 1st, indiebound.org, the ABA's consumer-facing online bookselling and marketing platform, will switch to using bookshop.org to handle sales and fulfillment. Wow. So that's the American Booksellers Association are now jumping in with bookshop.org completely. And it seems, so they estimate, this is, again, bookshop.org spokesperson, estimating that online sales for independent bookstores, including those that are on bookshop.org, IndieBound and Shopify and other platforms, amount to $100 million a year. And Amazon's online sales account for about $4 to $5 billion.
Mm.
And so what they're trying to do is capture 10% of that market that Amazon have and then benefit the indie community.
Well, my confusion, though, is that bookshops don't currently sell ebooks.
No, that's the point, is that that's what they want to do.
But why would it be in a publisher's interest to sell ebooks to bookshops to sell on bookshop.org?
Well, presumably you would put your book up on bookshop.org and you would, I don't know whether the ebook would then feature on the websites of these independent bookshops.
I don't know.
I think that's probably what they're trying to do. They create a shopfront which, you know, you can populate for your local bookshop. And they get a share of it. Now, here's the thing that Amazon have over any system out there, and that includes Kobo, which is the sort of next biggest thing, and Barnes & Noble and Waterstones in terms of ebook sales, is that Kindle Unlimited is the thing that anchors us with Amazon at the moment.
Absolutely.
Because 50% of our revenue comes from the Kindle Unlimited subscription model of people reading pages and us getting... and our authors getting a remuneration for that. And that's gone from about 40% when we started to at least 50% for most of our titles, and some titles as much as 60%.
Yeah, no, it's true. Some of our titles obviously appeal to Kindle Unlimited subscribers. So.
And that is monumental.
It is monumental. Because
and you know, that's something you can't just switch off as a revenue stream.
No, well, you can do, but then you're committed...
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. That's not to say that it's not at times feeling like an abusive relationship, because the number of times, and again, this week you've been battling with Amazon on behalf of some clients for our Archpub services, it's really difficult because the system constantly says no.
Yeah, or it just says, that's not in our jurisdiction. You need to contact your publisher. That's what I had this week.
Yeah, well, hang on. We are the publisher. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so we've got... still, big, big problems. And I think this is something that Amazon really need to address, because look, let's face it. As I was flicking through the news stories this week, I stumbled upon the one that we reported a month ago or so, which is that they are shedding jobs around the world and their profits are down. Look, improve your relationship with the people who provide you with the revenue, i.e. the creators, in terms of your books, at least, and stop messing this about.
Yeah.
As simple as that.
Because there will be a tipping point.
There will be a tipping point, and it's coming. And, you know, sometimes things get too big, too unwieldy, and they forget that actually it's about satisfying or sorting out things for people. And this is where AI does not work. But increasingly, and I was listening today to a report that said that one of the ministers in the current government, who used to be culture secretary but got demoted, is saying that more government business is going to be done by AIs in future. And I think this is, again, the wrong move.
Crikey, we really are turning into a science fiction novel.
Well, you know, it has been inevitable, and there are an awful lot of jobs which, frankly, an AI can do. And we all have to adjust to the fact that somehow we need to either do a job that they can't, or society as a whole just sort of uses the AI output and the money it creates and distributes it widely so that people don't, you know, because they can't work, don't have to work.
You say that, but 10 years ago, we would have thought a job that AI can't do, writing books.
Yeah, well, that's still jury out, but it can create text that resembles something.
Oh, yes. So it's not
okay,
that.
Have you got another story?
Well, it's just related to bookshop.org. So as we know, bookshop.org, since its founding, has done a huge amount to keep independent bookshops going and actually stop them from folding when, without its existence, especially with the COVID pandemic, a lot of them probably would have gone out of business. So there's a bookshop in Ramsgate, a really sweet little bookshop called Books Bodega. It's an indie bookshop, and it's only been open a year.
Bodega. Is it B-O-D-E-G-A?
Bodega.
Bodega.
Is that a word?
It's a Spanish word, isn't it?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Actually, yes, okay. And it hasn't even been open a year yet, but the owner, Sapphire Bates, has been struggling, and she realised that she wouldn't be able to pay her bills. So she just put out a tweet, as you do, just to try something. And she said, I can't pay my bills this month. Please help me. Please go to bookshop.org and buy books on our site and help us to pay the £800 for the bills this month. And she had an overwhelming response with 5.7 million views on her tweet. It was retweeted thousands of times, including by people like Sue Perkins and Ian Rankin. And in fact, she exceeded the sales that she needed. So it's just one of those happy stories, isn't it?
There's a lot of that about, isn't there? It's a lot about, it's a positive thing in the sense that someone's been saved, and that's great because they must have been.
At least for now.
For now, yeah. And we've seen this before with bookshops. But ultimately, we still need people to support bookshops more regularly.
Yeah, it's got to be sustained.
Yeah, it does. It does. Okay, that's a lovely story. Should we get to our interview?
I think we should.
Okay, let's talk to Nicole Johnson, who is a book coach. She's also a speechwriter, has been involved in politics for years and years and years, and worked for the UK government.
You make her sound old.
No. I mean, look, she's been focusing on the writing side of things for almost 20 years now. She came over from Australia and worked with the Labour government of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who is, we ought to reveal, the person that you were thinking about when you have a secret... fancy for our former Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown.
Well, everybody has a secret fancy that's a bit weird.
Yeah, okay. That's pretty weird, though. Anyway.
All I'm going to say to you is Katie Hopkins.
Yeah, okay. Oh, God, you had to drop that one in. Anyway, a complete end of the other end of the political spectrum. But yes, it has to be said that Nicole works with people to overcome the issues they have with their writing. And this is something that's sort of grown organically in the last couple of years. But as you'll find out from this interview, which it was, you know, it blew us over, and it was just one of these great energetic interviews. We just kindred spirits.
And
there's
another one where we spoke for another hour after we finished.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's true. But Nicole's got so much to offer and so much wisdom in the process of helping people write books. Let's speak to her. Nicole Johnson. Nicole Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on the Hobcast Book Show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're enormously grateful, and it's wonderful to speak to you. You're our first book coach.
Yes. Ooh. Our first one.
Oh dear, I could put you off them forever.
Well, I think people will be intrigued to know exactly what that involves, because, you know, when we're traditionally working with our authors, of course there's an element of coaching in the way that we publish. Yeah. And there's also an element where our editors get involved and you know, encourage changes. But actually, yeah, book coaching is a different thing altogether. It's more about holding a hand, isn't it, and guiding as the words go down on the page, not when the first draft is already there.
It kind of is. So I initially thought, I just discovered that I was coaching people for their books, and so it came about because I was just already doing it. And I have on Facebook, I have a free online writing tribe where I provide advice and things to people who also, I mean, people just want to gather together, and particularly during COVID, don't they? We writers want to be around people who love writing and books. So I discovered I was doing it, and it was a really interesting process, because I don't see myself as a writing coach. If you're coming to me and in 3 years you want to be, or even 3 months, you want to be the best writer you can be, there are, I believe, better people than me to do it. What I do and do well is get that book finished. And I think there's a massive amount of people out there. I mean, we all know this. I think in America, it's something like 90% of Americans want to write a book. And I think that's probably true across the board. And I just noticed some bizarre map. Actually, it was on the Daily Fail, but it was still a really, really good map on what dream jobs were all around the world. And the first, bizarrely, was pilot, which I think must be about travel. It's certainly true for Australia. And, of course, travel agency work was really popular in Australia because we could never get anywhere because it cost too much, right? But the second was writing, and that didn't surprise me at all. So I think what I realised is that people have an idea, they might even get started, but maintaining that motivation and finishing, I think, is a bit of a forgotten art. And also, I think we don't give ourselves permission to write. So all of a sudden, I realised what I was really good at was getting people to finish their books. Then people just kept approaching me. So I think, in a way, it was the people around me that decided. And I think sometimes, I mean, a lot of my clients are really busy business people, and actually it's busy people that get things done. And that's the truth of it. I think we all have this vision of writing being this lovely, lovely, glamorous experience, which hasn't been mine, I have to say. But also that if you have lots of time, you get lots done. But actually it's the people that have very little time that get lots done. So I think that's where it kind of came about. It felt like I was just already doing it. So I changed it from writing coach because I thought, you know, I have a friend called Andy up north who, we were both civil servants and policy advisors back in the day. And he went off and did his master's in novel writing and screenwriting. And he's a writing coach. Like he will take you through all of the aspects of writing, and of course I will take you through that if you're experiencing a particular difficulty on how to get it written or the style or the tone. I can do that, but it's really about getting your book finished, which is an art form.
Yeah, I mean, that's you're right, there's a clear definition and distinction between, you know, the writing element in terms of style and structure, I guess, but getting the motivation and finding the time and the methodology to actually get things down on the page is a different thing altogether.
And get actually to that end point, you shouldn't underestimate how difficult that is.
How many years have we done this podcast? 2 years now. And people are well aware that there is a work in progress that has actually not progressed in those 2 years of mine.
Oh, and that we is, need to have another little chat after this.
We do. It does sound that way. You know, although Rebecca has dangled the. We went to a guitar shop in Brighton, and I started.
This is part of your policy, isn't
no,
it?
No, and I
still an orthodox.
No, I stood there lovingly looking at this Fender Stratocaster and thinking, I really, 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 really want that. And Rebecca was standing on my shoulder, going, "Yeah, you can. I'm not going to stop you, but perhaps you'd feel better about buying it once you'd finished your book and printed it."
Oh, I like your thinking, Rebecca, and how perfect is it? I mean, geez, that is a huge incentive. Oh my goodness, that's a huge incentive. If that doesn't do it, I'm not sure what will.
Well, a puppy is the other possible.
Yeah. So you know,
it's the work I'm gonna dangle the thought of a puppy, because you would love a dog, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And you've been talking about it for months and months.
You've got all the cards here, Rebecca. That's all I'm saying. What also you need to ask yourself as well, I'm motivated towards something. I'm motivated towards seeing the book, yeah, finished with my name on it. But actually, a lot of people are just motivated by not hitting New Year's Eve and having to put that damn book on their New Year's resolution again, or saying to people when people say, so what's happening with your book? And you go, oh, I'm still writing it. So sometimes it's also understanding that motivation. You know, have you got to that point where you're fed up telling people you're writing it and you haven't done it? Or is it just seeing your name on that book and it being out there? And I personally don't think, I mean, I think there's a rare and amazing satisfaction in writing a book and finishing it and publishing it. I think it's just something that can never, ever be taken away.
That's true.
And nowadays, publishing is so much easier, isn't it? Because, you know, people can publish it themselves. Mm. So that's not the barrier so much, I think, as it used to be. It used to be, you know, you wrote your book and then you got this enormous mountain of finding somebody who's willing to publish it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a fair point. People think once the book's done, that's the hard bit. I mean, for you guys, that's not the hard bit. You know, that you know what you're doing in that. But yeah, no, it is. It is really, really difficult. But I personally think that it's, you know, I'm no fan of Amazon or it's the organisation, but it's democratised publishing. And, you know, none of us are under any illusions when some of the celebrities being published really should not be published and are not, in fact, even writing their own stuff. Now, I'm a ghostwriter, so I have no issue with that. I write for busy people who don't have the time to learn to write themselves. But, you know, it also, we know that the quality isn't necessarily in the public, in the traditional publishing anymore. But, you know, one of my coaching clients who discovered she was unwell and decided she was not waiting 18 months for her book to be published, just self-published, and she's done brilliantly. You know, every time I start to think about self-publishing, my brain just goes, yeah, not doing that, not doing that. Not interested. But she taught herself to do it. And I was super impressed. Mm. And she's really good at it. And then there's also guys like you, there's indie publishers out there. There's a lot of, and digital publishers, which just didn't seem to exist 5 minutes ago.
It is true. There's so many more options. And you can do both at the same time as well. You might decide one of your books that you've written is more suited for traditional, but you've got this idea that you want to keep control on and do yourself. So, yeah, it's so different to what it was when I started working and then publishing.
Yeah. It's interesting you're saying that your coaching side of things was organic in the way that it started up and that people gravitated towards you because, I mean, presumably I did some executive coaching training. I never really put it into practice with the BBC before I left. And some of that was about really asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. And listening to the answers and encouraging people to think for themselves. Is that really the approach that you take? Does that cover what happens when you're book coaching?
Yeah, I think so. To be honest, I think people get embarrassed about it, and also particularly if they're business people and they're good at what they do. You know, but actually, once you're stuck, you will know this, because when you're in the middle of that book, you can be completely lost. And I think what has happened is it was organic, that I was going, well, okay, let's try this, you know, and these things were working. And of course, every time I sit in front of it, I think, what if this person's going to come up with something I haven't dealt with yet? But actually, this doesn't happen, because as humans, we are very, very similar. So what might need to be tweaked is why you're choosing at some level not to prioritize your writing. So that's the bit I need to get to. That's the bit I need to understand. And actually, as often when people start talking to me, they can see what it is themselves. And we don't give ourselves permission. I mean, I'm exactly the same. My ghostwriting and book coaching stuff comes first, which inevitably means my own writing comes last. So, you know, I'm also having that exact same challenge you are, and trying to, and yet I follow my own advice. I write every day. It's just not always on my stuff, right? Mm. So it is about finding, and even with myself, finding what's the answer to that? What's the answer to that balance? And I think too, you are not in different places to me. You speak to writers all the time, so you're kind of subliminally picking up the messages and what we're telling, what authors tell themselves, and as an author yourself, you get it. You know yourself that actually it also sometimes the answer can be simple, but you need to be reminded of it. Every time I ghostwrite a memoir, I go back and I read through the rules of a memoir. And people think I'm crazy, but actually those are the bits we need to be reminded of. Mm. You know, those are the bits we need to, I imagine I will be 96 and still learning how to write.
You know? I think that's true, because also things change and trends change, and what people relate to changes over time anyway. So it's always good to try and be on top of all that. I'd like to know about your ghostwriting, actually, because I've kind of, I suppose you call it ghostwriting, ghost written a couple of books, non-fiction books, and one was called The Best Dad Ever. That was actually written by me, but the author had to be a bloke. He's called Tim.
So you created the author and the story?
Well, it was for a publisher.
Just kind of awesome. And I don't think you can kind of ghostwrite. I think you kind of do or you don't, and it sounds like you did.
Yes, I did. Yeah. So they commissioned me to write it, and then they chose the name of the author and published it under this imaginary person's name. It's not a real person.
Fascinating. So you had to almost create the character so you could speak in their voice. Oh, that is fascinating.
And I absolutely love doing it, and I would love to do more. So, you know, I wouldn't. How did you get into ghostwriting? You know?
But I had someone said it to me. I am a little bit thick. So sometimes I do things and I don't really realize I'm doing them. And all of a sudden, someone said, "You've spent 20 years writing on behalf of senior cabinet ministers and adopting their different tones and stuff." And you know, sometimes you're dumbing it down. And then when there was Gordon Brown, where you were really having to up your game, or there was Boris, where just short, really, really short, and two or three word sentences. So you in a way, I sat back and realized I did it. And I realized the other challenge was finishing a book length product, and I had done that for myself and for other people, you know. And I sat back and thought, wow, they're right, I actually do this. And then I realize as I speak to people, and I've been thinking a lot about this recently, because there was a debate on LinkedIn about, you know, is it important to capture the author's voice or tone? And I was like, well, you're not a ghost. The author's voice and tone, like, anybody can write a book and stick it under somebody else's name, right? And then it just reads like them. But actually, as you start to get to know people, you start to sit with the way they speak, and there are some cheats, obviously, some expressions and things they use, but actually you really do start to, I don't know, I was thinking about, I'm quite good at languages, and I wondered whether it's that mimicry or whether there's some sort of acting thing, which is fascinating with what you did, whether we are actually kind of almost semi-adopting another person's character as we do it. And I mean, my clients could not be more different. Which entertains the Gemini, and I don't know if you know about numerology, but I'm a 5. We need change. We can't be doing the same thing all the time. Mundane just does not.
I'm a Gemini.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'm a 5.
We need variety, right?
He's great at mimicry, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned a couple of names. I'm not going to do a Gordon Brown.
See, Gordon Brown, we have a bit of a special. Well, I have a bit of a special thing for Gordon Brown, because
he finds it very attractive.
I love an intelligent bloke with a social justice bent, and frankly, he's not a bad looking fella.
No.
I worked with him and I thought he was pretty attractive, frankly.
Well, I once had a dream about Gordon Brown.
A couple of you were revealing this.
Quite familiar with each other. This was years ago.
Yeah, no, I have to know.
Apparently he's a great kisser.
Really? Well, I have to say that my work didn't extend that far, but of course the competition was the absolutely stunningly beautiful and wonderful Sarah Brown. So I didn't get a sense that he ever, oh, and what a joy that was, working for a politician who really only wanted to kiss his own wife.
Oh,
yeah, after Boris, yeah. That was a dream. Never had to worry about waking up and finding out who else he was having a baby with.
Right, right. So we're referring to Boris there, I guess.
Yes, we are. Oh, no, definitely not Gordon Brown. No, definitely
no,
not.
No, Gordon Brown's lovely. But I loved working with him. Gifted a mug with Gordon Brown on it
Why don't you go and get it?
Oh, I don't know where it is.
Oh, okay. Well, I've got a sort of Toby mug.
I love that. Well, do you know what I loved about working with him is I got to like him more and more. And I have to say, and respect him more and more. And that definitely does not happen in politics. It's very rare to find someone. And the more you find out about them, the more you think, gosh, wow. I remember my first meeting with him was with White House officials, and I'd said to the special advisor at the time, who's now Lord Wood, Stuart Wood, and great, really, really accessible. I went to him with, I have been here for 2 weeks. If he asks me a question, I'm going to go, eh? You know, so please rescue me. I didn't have to worry at all. We sat in there. He had them eating out of his hands. And these were guys that briefed George Bush twice a week. And they came out and said, he's awesome. We've never met anyone like him. And I went, on one hand, I was like, yeah, he is. And on the other hand, I was like, you're the superpower and you've never met anyone as awesome as him. You know, that's really worrying.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think, you know, we lack politicians of depth to that degree at the moment. But, you know,
oh, totally.
And it's very interesting. Every time it's a rare occasion when he enters public debate nowadays, maybe every 3 months or something, he'll say something. And it's absolutely nailed on every single time. And, you know, whereas, dare I say it, his erstwhile colleague, Lord Blair, is he Lord? No, I can't remember now. Anyway, Tony Blair will enter the debate and say something outlandish, like the ID card thing. Yeah.
I was supposed to. So I had worked in Australia with two blokes, Kim Beazley and Jeff Gallop. Jeff was Tony Blair's best man at their wedding. They were each and you know, they knew each other really well. So when I first came over here, I was supposed to work with Blair. And when I contacted Jonathan Powell, he sent me a letter saying, I'm so sorry, but we're a sitting government. You've come over too late. The positions are gone. And I was really upset about it because I knew that both Kim had given me a written reference and I knew that Jeff had spoken to him. And I am eternally grateful because after Iraq, I lost respect. I couldn't get past it. And also, I just don't think I'd have had the constructive relationship with Brown and his advisors because we, in principle, absolutely on the same wavelength. And I think that showed he really wanted to do things for people who were low income and disadvantaged. And that was what drove me. So here I am doing special policy in an economic policy unit and stepping on department stories all over the place and loving it because we felt like we could change the world. So I was really grateful not to have worked with Blair.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I can see that. Mm. I mean, I covered the 97 Labour conference that just won the election. It's in Brighton. And I was the local reporter for Brighton, so I got to go to all the things. And what happened that week was that Blair had nothing else to do waiting for his big speech and so kept bundling in on every other minister's visit. So, that, you know, you always do the setup, don't you? You go and on one occasion it was Blunkett was going to see somewhere that was disadvantaged, White Hawk Estate, I think it was. And Blair tags along and takes all the camera time.
Yeah, he does.
Cherie was with him. And I just remember this. He got a question he couldn't answer. So the first question from this this community panel was a mother with a little baby who was at this point crawling across the table trying to get Cherie's pearls from her neck, right? And she's going, I want to know, Mr. Blair, I want to know what you're going to do. You say you're going to be tough on crime, but my washing went missing last week for the third time in a month. What are you going to do about them who's taking the washing off my line? And sorry, I'm pointing. I'm just getting gesticulation here.
Get it? Yeah.
Goes, ah, well, you know, I'm not sure. Yeah, I say I'm going to be tough on crime, obviously, but I can't really specifically be tough on people stealing clothes off a line. But, you know, I'll pass it on to the relevant minister and we'll see what we can do.
You know, oh, you are good. Flummoxed. You are good.
He is. Yes.
Big smile.
And couldn't answer it because wouldn't have had a clue what his policy was. And you know, he did this when I was working with him, and I am a bolshy madam. And, you know, so I know that will surprise you. So I got a call from someone who shall remain nameless, who I really liked at number 10, who I really rate. And he said, I've heard that you're, you know, doing this, and I just want you to know that the Prime Minister is happy to speak at that event. And I went, ah, thank you so much. Hung up the phone and went over my dead body. Yeah, Brown's done the time. He's done. And so many, I was having this conversation with a taxi driver the other day. So many of what Blair is attributed with having achieved were Brown's ideas.
Yeah. Yes.
And I mean, I have no time for Tony Blair. To me, he was never Labour and he shouldn't have been there. I was at a Ben Elton concert in Australia in 97, just after they'd been elected, and it must have been really exciting being in Brighton. And he stood up and said, it's the first time I've ever done a show in Australia where we've had a Labour Party in government, and the place went wild. So he had a long way to fall, and he fell back the whole way, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. I had no time for it. Bizarrely, I did really like Cherie Blair. And also, I was astounded by off camera how beautiful she is. She really looks rubbish on camera, but actually she's really quite beautiful. You know, a whole other ball game to Sarah, obviously. But yeah, wow. You are good at mimicry. I'm really impressed by that. Well, that, so if my theory,
I sometimes get Michael Caine at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I'm not doing that now. I'm not doing that now. People have heard that too often. But the embarrassing thing is when you're doing an event like that and dealing with David Blunkett, who I really respected in many respects, but trying to get him to point the right way for the camera was near impossible. And actually, I had to break protocol and actually put both hands on his shoulders, because I'd say initially I'd be going, right, okay, well, the camera's just to your left, and he would do a 45 degree turn.
And then
okay, right, well, for people who aren't familiar with David Blunkett, if outside the UK, David Blunkett was Home Secretary at the time and was blind and guide dog.
See, I was in Japan, so I don't remember.
But then I would say, right, okay, Mr. Blunkett, if you could just turn back the other way a little bit, and then he would do another 45, he'd do 90 degrees. Yeah. So he'd be pointing, you know, off sideways again. So actually I had to physically put my hands on his shoulders and turn around. You could see the security detail bristling, you know, and he was charming, actually really charming. The person I got the most.
So when was that though? Because his charm definitely waned for me. When I was in Australia, I said to Chris, my husband, I could work for him when he was education minister.
Yeah.
But then of course he became a bit of a head kicker for Blair on kind of immigration stuff.
Oh, to a degree,
I had to babysit him in a event, and I found him really difficult.
Did you? Well, on that occasion, I think it's possibly not during it was during the election. So he was visited. Brighton was a real important battleground because it was all Tory, and afterwards it went all Labour, all three seats.
Yeah, so that's what I'm really struggling with, that because I would have thought that Brighton was Labour.
It was true blue Tory for decades.
I'm surprised by it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then demographic shift happened through the 90s, really. But the other occasion was during that election campaign. I had to attend a rally on Brighton Pier with John Prescott, and that day the TUC, the Scottish TUC, were meeting up in Scotland, were saying that they were going to demand that the new Labour government, should they get in, would allow secondary picketing to be re-established, which had been banned by the Conservatives. And so I got a phone call from the national desk, news desk in London, get a question in from, it was Milbank or whatever, they were phoning me and going, right, we need you to get a question to Mr. Prescott about this. Mm-hmm. And so his advisors came up to me just before the interview, and we're on the Brighton Pier, and it'd been a complete farrago, and he's got all his supporters around him and all this sort of thing. And they say, right, what are you going to ask him? And I just fibbed and said, well, I guess I'll ask him some local stuff. So you could see they went back to him. He gets his little check sheet out of all the stuff he wants to talk about Brighton.
And that's a tick. Local issues are fine.
Yeah. He was cribbing as just before I got to him. And then my opening question is about the Scottish TUC pressure. And he got completely flustered and lost it. And I'll tell you, we've got 10 points here for the election. That's what people want to talk about. They don't want to talk about the Scottish TUC. And by the way, I love Brighton. And he's talking to the big crowd here. I used to come here with my family and I, you know, all of that sort of thing. At that point, I got...
God love him.
That was the one question I got. And then I had this feeling of two arms hooking my... Because I'm holding the microphone as I am talking to you now. Yep. And they hooked me and pulled me back out,
you're out
of range.
Now.
And that was it. One question and a fluster. 2 minutes of him blustering his way through it. It was fantastic.
I do love that. And I mean, you know, that I guess that was the other thing about Brown. I used to sit there and think, you know, I am not stupid. You know, I had 2 degrees by then in politics. And I am sitting there just thinking, I could work for 50 years and not know everything you know.
Mm.
And I think that really... Because I just always assumed that the Prime Minister should be cleverer than me. And so when I find myself in a position where, gosh, the last five haven't been, I mean, it does disturb you, right? It kind of pulls the rug out. You think, but I kind of assumed we're in safe hands.
Yeah, it's a bit not. Worrying.
Exactly. I can imagine. I mean, I wasn't a fan by the time I was... doing the David Blunkett thing, and I didn't find him easy. But he was a fundamentally different person, I think, than what he had been.
Yes.
I felt his principles shifted massively. And as the education minister, I used to think he was brilliant. I mean, watching from Australia, I used to think he was great.
Yeah. Let's go back to the ghostwriting then. In terms of when you're working with a client and we've talking about that, getting the voice right, so what is that line you dance? You know, because I know a leading ghostwriter as well as a university colleague of mine, and he used to be a broadcaster and it does a lot of this stuff.
Oh wow. Yeah.
Tony Horn is his name, and he spends a lot of time with the client. I mean, hours and hours and hours of conversations. Is that the process that you go through?
That's how I do it. So basically, I meet someone, they tell me what their book is about, who their market is. We kind of look at it, you know, so a business book is going to be somewhere between kind of 30 and 50 or 30 and 60,000. Often they're going to be self-published, so that the amount doesn't matter. Or the other end of it is kind of the memoirs, which are big, you know, they're big stories. And, you know, everybody thinks they want to write an autobiography, and just for the tip, pretty much nobody wants to write an autobiography. So unless you're, I don't know, David Attenborough, nobody cares about your autobiography. A memoir is, I have a message and these are the stories that are relevant to that message. And I think that's the first thing I have to say to people. So then I will sit down. Once we've done that, I look at what they want to talk about and what they want to say. And if it's a memoir, I need to break up their life into kind of parts. And so I usually do it in parts and then with chapters underneath. So I get a basic outline of the book, whatever it is. And then I will spend the next 6 to 8 weeks gathering content. And that is pretty much, not completely, but pretty much all on Zoom. So, you know, I can spend 2 or 3 hours a session, and there can be, depending on how many clients I've got at a time, there can be a couple of sessions a week. So you really have to trust the person that you're speaking to. And I cannot, I mean, if I had a pound for every person that says to me, I've never told anyone that before. And, you know, so despite it being Zoom, and I do say that to people when they come to speak to me, one of my clients calls me the anti-marketing machine. excuse me, because they go to me and I say, okay, fine, but you're going to have to spend 5 months with me. So I'm going to introduce you to these other ghost riders and you need to decide who you can spend, you know, 5 months with. And he keeps going, oh, for heaven's sake, I just need to write my book. So basically, once I've done that, then you gather the content. And with memoirs, you do tend to start chronologically. And I think that doesn't matter. Where you start also doesn't matter, because at that stage you can write all the bits in whatever order you want. At some point you're going to have to fill in the gaps. And then I will draft up chapter one and we will back and forward until the client is happy with chapter one. But by the time I've drafted chapter one, I've often spent a month or 6 weeks with them. And therefore, it somehow seems to reduce the chances they're going to hate it. And I'm really clear. I'm robust. I am not going to care. If you send this back and say, I hate this, that's okay with me. And even if you don't know what you hate about it, we'll just try something else. But I think the value, and it sounds like this is what your colleague does as well, you know, by the time you've got there, you do have a sense of what it is they're trying to say. And even if you haven't quite grasped what the book is fundamentally about. And that's the other thing I'd say, by the time you finish that book, it's not always about what you thought it was about, you know. So I always kind of have a working title, but that changes all the time. So that's kind of how I do it, and that's how it seems to work. And for people that are busy, some of them prefer to record and just send me stuff through, or send me stuff they've written or whatever. But yeah, I mean, that every ghostwriter has their own process, but that works best for me.
Do you know what it reminds me of? Painting a portrait. If you're going to paint someone's portrait, you want to spend hours with them to get a feel for them. It's a bit like that.
And their expressions. It somehow feels like you do get to know them, and it's intense. I mean, I you know, imagine on these reality shows where you're shoved in a room with someone for 2 weeks, you get to know them much more than in a different circumstance. But yeah, that's what works best for me. And so I find the chapter one, which is the most difficult chapter of all of them, I find that actually a lot isn't as difficult to get the tone and voice right, because you're becoming familiar with them.
But do you find they speak to you when you're trying to sleep at night because you spent time with them in your head?
I you know, the whole writing thing, I have to say, it's when you were saying you had that idea in the kitchen. I mean, for me, it's the shower, because, of course, I can't write down the idea if I get the. So it would make absolute sense that your best ideas would happen. And, I find that really frustrating. And also, if I've been working on a client's book, because I write late at night, as I said to you the other day, I write really late at night. So lying there, just sitting there with this story going through my head and thinking, I probably do need sleep at some point. So they do kind of live with you.
Yeah. I mean, I think what the thing that strikes me, and the difficulty I could see doing this, is as a journalist, I would have to mug up and have a wide appreciation of lots of things. But when you're dealing with someone, one of your business clients, writing a ghost book or whatever it is, they have a particular expertise in the world they understand. So how much work do you have to put in at that stage of approaching that client to understand what their world, so that you build that empathy and they can, you know, you're not having to sort of keep stopping and saying, just a moment, you've used an acronym there. Can you clarify that for me? Is that part of the process too?
Well, yeah, yes and no. And in fact, you're a Gemini, so you'll kind of get this. We're really good at knowing a little bit about a lot of things. Yeah. We're very much kind of jack of all trades, and we can adapt. And actually, where this comes in is also, we are very curious. We like to understand, you know. And so therefore, and also having the variety of clients, you just kind of, so at the moment I'm dealing with a special forces person. I've got this amazing client. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I am really lucky. I've only ever had one terrible client. We're divorced quickly. But one special forces, another who's you know, got an OBE for her contribution to film and television and bought Black and Asian television into the UK and isn't even a footnote under all of those old white blokes that took the credit for her work. And another who I've just finished her book on Chinese horoscopes and dating, which was so fun. And now we're doing Feng Shui. So what I there have always been, there's been moments like, you know, one of my clients, she's just met all these amazing people and I have to keep going back and say, who was that? I mean, I record it with Otter and I will put little question marks. And then special forces, I don't know anything about guns. I don't know what different types of bombs there are. But actually what the advantage he said was, one, that's what these books are all full of. They're all full of Superman. They're all full of all this stuff. And he said, I don't want it to be like that, because I was very upfront with him. And to be honest, when he contacted me and said he wanted to write a book on the SAS, I said, I'm a raving lefty pacifist. I'm not your girl. So we met and I was so fascinated by how different he was to what I expected him to be. Mm. That we've ended up, not only am I writing his book, but we have become friends, which just blows my mind. And I'm forever going, yeah, treat me like I'm six. So, you know, what's the difference between the artillery fire you did and the mortar fire?
Yeah. Yeah.
I bet you're great on a quiz team.
Well, do you know, except my memory's terrible. Don't tell anyone that. But I am rubbish on a quiz too. However, my editor is apparently amazing. She lives in Suffolk. And I did say, got a quiz down here. You're going to have to come down and give us a chance. yes, you do have to go deep. I mean, and I keep having to remind my Feng Shui client that I don't get it. Actually, and so you are going to have to tell me, and I will do my own research. But the only other thing about that sort of thing is that the interpretations are often quite different, and she's dug really deep into it, so she's, you know, she's got a real solid knowledge of it. But actually there's a part of me that enjoys it, but I do my criteria as they come to the party. If I'm researching, your price is different. So yeah. While I will build my understanding, because that matters to me to get it right, you are bringing the content to me, and your contract is based on you providing me with the content. Yeah. And thus far, that hasn't been an issue at all.
That's fair enough. I mean, I guess that, gosh, I've lost my question now. I'm going to throw this bit out.
Oh, no, Adrian, you make me feel so much better, because that's been happening to me a lot in the last year or so.
What is this thing that, you know, when you go...
fog.
Well, it just goes poof and it goes, yeah, right, it's gone.
Because the problem is you say something else and then you're off. We flick. It's like walking from one room to another. It's actually physiologically proved that if you walk from this room with the thought and you walk into the next room, it will go, because your perspective has shifted.
That is just, yeah.
I'm just blaming the fact that we got COVID on moving day. So,
moving day, that's not good.
That's deadly.
The best one I've ever had.
Let's talk about your fiction then, because as you've already said, you know, other things take precedence currently in your writing world. So, And in a sense, there must be an element of, I mean, I don't ascribe too much imposter syndrome to you, but there must be an element of, hang on a second, I'm telling people how to get through their books, but I'm not doing it myself. Is that a factor?
There really is. And I like to think it's that, do you know what? I wouldn't want to go to a skinny personal trainer or who's never, ever struggled with their weight or their fitness or whatever. And I just have to hope that that's how people feel, that, you know, if actually writing's easier for them, they pump out books all over the place, but they're not someone that are going to have experienced the challenges. I have exactly the perfect job, and the balance isn't right. It really isn't right. And that's what this year is about, tweaking how I get it right. Because I met up with a few friends, writing friends, that I went an Arbonne course with, we think it was 2007. That's how long ago it is. And we haven't met since before COVID. And we were all talking about how all of us write, but just finding the time to justify our creative writing is very difficult. Now, what I think is the big deal with that, and I've been having this conversation with people recently, is what makes me love writing is that first draft. So at the moment, I am in redraft stage for two of my own books and three ghostwriting projects. So I'm actually in the bit I really do not like.
Oh, God, yeah.
In the muddy bit.
And then you just feel a bit stuck. You don't, you know, there's a real satisfaction when I finished yesterday, this client's last chapter and sent it off to her. I went, oh, great. And I've sat down with someone recently who's one of my coaching clients, actually, when we were talking through. She's the one that's just self-published the most amazing debut novel, Real Gone Kid, by Kathleen Fredrickson, and it's brilliant. That's the other thing I've started to realize is that there's, in my head, I don't have the publishing background, but in my head I can tell a good story, and hers was a really good story, and you very rarely meet someone whose debut novel is that good. You know, most of us, me included, have to write a few that are rubbish before we get to something that's worth publishing. But I, you know, I have to get that balance right, because that's what feeds my joy. And so, you know, I'm talking to you at this point where I've sat down with this person and bizarrely they've come back to me and realised there is a gap in March in my diary where I can sit down and get the redraft of my cozy crime off to this digital publisher who I'd love to work with. And then I can start my next one. I can justify starting the next one, because that's the bit I love. And you know, you must have the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it is, and all I will say is that is my target for getting it right this year. Yes. So the rest is in place. I just haven't got the balance quite right. But, you know, I think too, I grew up in the 80s. I'm terribly A-type. We get our work done first.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's true. Same for me.
Well, a little bit like that for me. No.
Not quite the same.
Well, that's, yeah, you need to be teaching me how to do it. I am missing it a lot, and I think my writing isn't as good when I'm not having that creative outlet. So I think what happened is I set aside to draft over Christmas, got COVID on moving day, then got meningitis, then got a kidney infection, and then got some gut thing. And so there was all my 5 or 6 weeks that I'd set aside to redraft.
Wiped out.
So, yeah.
Right. And you know, we'd not had COVID for 3 years, and I knew it wasn't going to be good when I got it. And it was one of our friends helping us move, so we couldn't even be cranky about it. We basically just fried my brain. So all this time that I thought I had. So actually, I do think I'll get it right. And as my husband, who's really great, he just keeps saying, okay, so it's just a bit delayed. You know, but I would say to everyone out there, you do need to be getting some of the joy out of it, because some of writing is just a drudge.
That's true.
And you know, you need to know the bits you love, the bits you don't love. And also I just bully myself. I mean, we've got a 10-minute method in the tribe, so, and I do follow my own advice, which is, I don't do it in any other area of my life, just in writing. But the 10 minute method, if you're really busy, and this could really help you as well, Adrian, is don't edit, don't review, don't research in that 10 minutes. Just drop those words down. Just get them down. Don't even think about whether they're good or not. You're going to have to edit them anyway. Even if they're brilliant, you're going to have to edit them. But if you, most of us write at 40 words a minute, that's the average person. You're not the average person. You're probably going to write much, much faster than that. That means 400 words in 10 minutes, 2,800 words in a week, with just over an hour's investment. You've done that book in 6 months. Even if you've written none, you've done that book in 6 months.
That's a fair point. And of course, you know, being a journalist and broadcast journalist to boot, I had to write incredibly quickly. And indeed, you would have done when you were writing speeches. You know, you get a couple of hours notice that so-and-so has decided to go and speak to WY in Nottingham and they need something. bang, yeah, you've got to knock it out. And
so it's playing to all of your skills, all of your experience. And yeah, and I'll tell you this right here and now, if you write in bursts, you may finish your book. If yeah, you write 10 minutes a day or more, say you sit down, you do your 10 minutes, and here's where it's beautiful. If you sit down for that 10 minutes and it's like walking through treacle and you're hating every second of it, it's 10 minutes. You can bully yourself to do 10 minutes. But what will happen is this, I don't know if you've heard of this Jim Collins flywheel effect, building momentum. The more you turn up for that 10 minutes, the advantages are those creative juices keep going. You yeah, also don't sit down and go, I've got this long and I just have to remember where I'm at. So I've spent all of my writing time trying to reacquaint myself with my book. But when you, and Maya Angelou is right, the more you use that creative juices, the more it comes. It doesn't run out. It gets better and better. And, you know, I had this project manager in my writing tribe who said, look, I think this theory is complex. I think it doesn't work. I don't think 10 minutes can possibly be enough. Anyway, I said, fine, give me a week and do it. Oh, my God, he is its greatest advocate now.
That's amazing.
I love that.
And it, you know what it is? It's in its simplicity, because if you can force yourself not to censor or edit yourself in that 10 minutes, you also get the joyful bit back and you start seeing that word count going. And as I say, even if you're the best writer in the world, you're going to have to edit. So what's the difference if that 10 minutes is rubbish?
True. That's very wise.
Yeah, 30 minutes.
This, yeah, absolutely brilliant. This feels like the moment we should bring in the random question. but I want to, but actually, you know, I'm going to postpone it just for a second. So, uh-huh, you know, on tenterhooks, because I want to ask. I mean, I was I'm always intrigued, given that you've got a method and you've worked very thoughtfully about all of these aspects. Are there any tools that you use? I mean, I think you mentioned some type of software or something when you're doing your interviews with your clients and stuff like
with
that.
With the ghostwriting, absolutely. So I love Zoom. I feel like I build a connection with people on Zoom. And I used to use Skype, and you know, all power to use Skype, but it was rubbish. Yeah. I record it, I drop it into otter.ai. Now there's loads of transcription services. Otter just works for me. And yeah, also you can do this where you link it up. So say we're having an appointment, but I've organized it and I'm recording it. I can tell Otter and it will do the background stuff. So then it transcribes, which is often very interesting, especially if there's lots of different accents.
Yes.
And what I will, and that just gives me it. So if I go back, I can remember everything that's been said, and that's the we'll remember the bits we, you know, that stand out, but we don't remember the detail. And then I can also listen. So Otter, so I can click on something that says something random, and you think, well, that can't be what they said, and you can click on it and then hear what they actually said in that bit. So it's not perfect. I will say that with one of my clients, he had someone who I didn't even think sounded a bit like him, and Otter just could not work out. It's only ever happened once, but could not work out which one of them was saying it, which was deeply frustrating. I think that's brilliant. I'm a terrible technophobe. So I use Word, to be honest. I am not exotic. If I have to do a plan, it's in Word. I've been talking to a fabulous author called Claire Sheldon and Marion Todd. I don't know if you know Marion Todd, but yes, she is master of planning. Her process, and I look at it in wonder, but I am such a pantser. But Claire Sheldon's playing with Excel and she's a pantser. So I'm watching with gated. I mean, I'm never going to do it on Excel because I
just ain't going to happen, though.
It's just, I do not. My husband, bizarrely, is an expert on it and he can make it do anything, but yeah, I don't like it. But I did download this lifetime supply of something called Plotter that I am.
Yes. We've talked to Plotter.
We've had
yes,
Plotter on the podcast.
They were on a few weeks ago, yeah.
Really? And because it seems one of the issues I'm finding is I don't have the tolerance with tech. So if I have to learn it, I'm not going to do it because I'm just not interested enough. I'd rather just get it done.
Yeah.
But Plotter seems, and I say this with huge hesitation because I haven't used it a lot, it seems quite simple.
Mm.
And that, for me, will be the attractive bit. I've actually need to redraft, so I'm not doing it before the draft. What I'm doing is going back to make sure that the plot points work. And in crime, as you know,
yes,
they have to work.
Yes,
I sent it off to the digital publisher, I have to say, having thought that I had lined it all up beautifully and completely missed an entire, like, major. There were only three major clues and I missed one of them completely. And I only felt better when Emma Christie, who's also an awesome crime writer,
yes,
said, I did that.
Well, no, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, you know, I mean, we're not bigging up Plotter unnecessarily, and we're not getting paid for it. But that was the thing that struck me for someone with my brain type and attention deficit disorder. It was right in the way, you know, right squarely where I needed it in terms of being simple to understand and to populate with the stuff I wanted to put in it. I haven't signed up for it permanently yet, but.
Yeah,
it feels,
I
mean, like
when I looked at it, was the Lifetime was crazy cheap, and I just thought, oh well, yeah. I won't have to think about it again. Did you say, do you actually have attention deficit?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
So I wonder, and it's irrelevant to me now, I think, but I have always had a very, very odd brain, and I this is not going to go somewhere you don't want to go on this podcast. It's very, very, but all through my degrees and all through my writing, I have always had to have the television on when I write.
Mm.
And I think it's because part of my brain has to be entertained for me to concentrate. And I spoke to a friend of mine whose child is ADHD, and she said some of those things, and that is exactly with me. I remember this lovely digital publisher telling me how the Amazon algorithm worked. And honestly, I couldn't even pretend to be interested. It was like, my brother, no, I am not going there. And I can't force it to go there. So I just have to. So I said, okay, clearly I am never going to get this. And I wonder, I've always wondered, you know, so, and I would say this to people sometimes, so I took a lot of flack in my degrees for watching TV while I was, and I can't be watching subtitles, obviously, that is just too complicated. But, you know, if I have Vera or something on in the background, I will get frustrated if there's nothing on the telly that is going to entertain that part of my brain so that I can write.
Right. I totally with you. No, I mean, I have to have I usually have my headphones on, or I will even have YouTube running on my phone while I'm doing it.
I've been binge watching Waterloo Road while working.
So maybe it is a thing, and I think that's what's interesting is that that some of us have found strategies with, and I had, it never really occurred to me, but when I sat down and spoke with this friend of mine, she went, gosh, they're really quite, you know, they sound a lot like, and also I just don't have the tolerance for information that doesn't interest me.
Yes, yeah. Totally, really. Totally.
My boredom threshold is non-existent.
Well,
and
absolutely.
Yet I never get bored because I read and write.
Yeah, that's my experience of my life.
It's hyper-focus on the things you want to be hyper-focused on.
And things start, I mean, for me, you know, thinking about my sort of the dissolution of my BBC career of 25 years was when I got moved, had a new boss who was a disciple of absolute silence at the workplace.
Oh God!
Even though we're in a busy newsroom,
couldn't do it.
You know, open plan newsroom. We're doing sports news. He would always be asking people to be quiet. And he measured your productivity and how long you were sat down. So
that's just presenteeism by another name.
Yeah, and I couldn't do it because I'm a great one for jumping in and out of my chair. I'm Zebedee, and I much preferred it when I was running around, sort of plate spinning. In a journalistic environment.
And then when you burst good.
Yeah, yeah.
All done. I mean, I can get it, you know,
exactly.
I bursted and did 9,000 words a couple of weeks ago, and I can't maintain that. But, you know, that's the thing. If you worked, this was the thing about COVID, wasn't it? That at the end of the day, so I want to say this to you because I ended up doing this because I have a disability. And I didn't know I had a disability. I had a med and it completely destroyed my mobility. Yeah. So all of a sudden I can't commute. So I've got 2 degrees and 20 years and these awesome references. And they say, you can work from home one day a week. And I'm like, but I can't commute on those other days. By the time I get to work, I'm in pain and I'm exhausted. And also I don't operate well in an open plan. I then have to go home and do all my work. right? So I was one of those people whose productivity you could see was much better when I was at home. So anyway, I'm mortified, and I'm guessing you're going to tell me exactly the same story, that all of a sudden what I was qualified to do, I couldn't do anymore.
Yeah.
And that was devastating, utterly devastating, especially because it was so wrong. There was not a thing I couldn't do in my job at home. You know, and I had a desk at home. It wasn't hot desks. And I had really good internet. You know, all of it was fine. But now I'm really grateful, because I think I do something. And also, I did say to Chris, my husband, the other day, if I had to work for this government, I'd be suicidal. But, you know, so it was a good thing. And I love what I do.
Yeah.
And because you work for yourself, you can find those ways of doing things.
Absolutely.
So did you feel pushed out when this guy came in, because you just couldn't?
Oh, totally. I was completely misused. I mean, you know, everything I did and the way that I did it was counter to the normal, you know, the people who sort of get into management at this stage of their careers, you know, they toe the line, they la, la, la. I was completely the opposite. And you know, being neurodiverse in this way, I didn't know at the time. I mean, I only subsequently found out that this was a problem. But all the other things that come with ADD, including saying the wrong things at the wrong time, but not meaning anything by it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the current culture, everything you say is essentially a window into your soul, and yep. You know, everyone feels that they've got an opportunity to just pile in and you know, cancel you. I was falling foul of that, and yet, you know, for the rest,
bear with us.
No worries.
Batteries ran out suddenly on my machine.
No, how frustrating. It only ever does that when you need it not to.
We ought to get to the random question as well.
Yeah, I've got the random question ready.
Okay, just need to hook these out.
Can we shoot my fingernails?
If I go that way,
no. I have none.
Nor do I. And my dad, poor soul, he has a very rare condition called yellow nail syndrome.
Oh, yeah. They literally fall out.
Yeah.
The first thing he said to me when I met him was, don't look at my fingers.
Yeah. They've actually improved now, but.
Gosh, that's really interesting. You'd wonder what was going on there, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Are you sorted? Because I was going to say to you, I think that's really important. I think that's the other message that I would love everybody to get, is that being neurodivergent, you know, we need to be representative, and the publishing industry will catch up with this. But we need to be neurodivergent because it is not dissimilar to films and television. People want to see people like them, people they can relate to in what they watch and definitely in what they read. And I think the publishing industry does need to grow up. Mm. However, ADD or ADHD clearly has not precluded either of us from writing. And in fact, I would say if we can work, and I don't understand a world where you don't look at your team and say, this is what works for Joe and this is what works for Molly. Therefore, Joe and Molly do it differently because they still get their work done. And to me, I've never understood that lack of flexibility or presenteeism. That just is weird and old-fashioned. But also with dyslexia, I wanted to raise it here. I've had so many people say, I cannot write because I'm dyslexic. Now, one, you can write when you're dyslexic, and there's all sorts of spell checks and grammar checks out there which make it irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And editors, thank you God for these beautiful people. But also, if you even have a block to it, just record yourself and put it on a transcription and then go through it and make sure it says what you wanted it to say. You're going to get it edited anyway. So for me, there's not a block. There's not a problem with someone being dyslexic or having some sort of neurodivergence in writing. It may, in fact, be an asset.
Yeah, superpower. Use it as your superpower.
Absolutely. Well, you have a superpower, my love.
What, my random question?
Which is the way your brain works. And we're about to get the ultimate.
I am slightly nervous.
Yeah, neurodiverse questions. So let me, if you don't mind, I'm going to do the voice.
Do the voice.
I should do it as Gordon Brown, but Rebecca's random question.
Right, so you know the question, and people, this is a common question, is if you had three wishes, what would you wish for? It's not quite that.
Right. It's,
if you had a wish, but it couldn't be for world peace or end poverty. It's got to be something to make the world a better place that would make you personally more happy. Now, if I give you mine as an example, that might help you. I was in the kitchen. I was thinking about worms. And I thought, if I had this wish, I would make worms cute and furry.
Right.
Oh. But there you go. It's got to be something that would make your life...
Wow. Oh, that's really tough.
That's a window into your mind, my love.
That's really tough. Ah, oh, that's really tough.
Sorry.
Because, I mean, you've been in a position where, you know, as you said with Gordon Brown, you know, an idea could spark within your team and it might have led to something that improves the world.
I'm an individual. Look, there's so much. I mean, you know, obviously, it's not even world peace. I think it'd be greed for me. Just getting rid of greed, I think, would probably solve all of the world's problems because we wouldn't be coveting other people's land and having wars. But I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I think it'd be something if it was in the worm related thing. I think it would be bees. I think that bees are extraordinary creatures that we rely on. And, you know, I'm quite focused on this because I'm a massive caffeine addict. And if the bees go, there's not going to be any coffee. I mean, sod food and stuff, right? We wouldn't have anything either, but we didn't have coffee. And I think what I have witnessed is that people are frightened of bees.
Yes, they are.
And I don't understand it because a bee will not sting you because they die when they sting you unless you threaten them. So I think I wish that for some reason bees were, everybody saw what beautiful, incredible, life-giving creatures they are, which sounds incredibly random.
No, but it's great.
If I had land, I would have bees. Because we had bees down the road in Beckenham, would you mind? Urban Beckenham.
Yeah, Beckenham,
beautiful honey. None of the neighbours treated with pesticides, so none of our veggies and stuff were rubbish. And it deals with histamines. If you have local honey with your local pollen and you take it a few months before allergy season, you don't get allergies. I mean, I just think they're kind of magic.
Wow, I did not know that. I mean, it's funny you bring up the bees because we've been watching Clarkson's Farm where he has bees, and in the first series, one bee gets through his protective gear, crawls all the way up his leg, goes down his underpants, and gets him right in the.
Just stinging them.
It stings him. Perseveres.
Clever bees, aren't they? Because stinging Clarkson on the bollocks just sounds the dog's bollocks to me. I would like to sting Clarkson.
I think he's an interesting. There are two sides to him.
There's not. You're just very kind and generous. There's not two sides to him. He's an ass. Excuse me, but he isn't. I just an hideous human being. And I personally do think maybe we could just train them to sting the Clarksons and Farages of the and the
that's of the world.
Everybody
loves bees, but the bees only sting the Clarksons and Farages.
Exactly. They would be doing a public service.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing I would want in life is to change is people being organised once they've paid at the till to not spend then half an hour putting it all back in their purse and, you know, just get a shift on. Because I used to work on tills a lot. When I was a teenager, and it just drive me potty. I'm working my ass off to try and, you know, get the back
people
sorted
through
out.
And they're just having a doddle.
That sort of thing. Please just get yourselves organized, figure out where your purse is before you have to pay, because then you can spend 5 minutes trying to ferret around trying to find the damn thing.
Once it's done,
you're
gone. He can stand in line forever and then get to wherever he is and then go, oh, now what shall I have? And you're just like, oh my god, you've been 25 minutes in that queue.
Well, this is our thing. I mean, I decide in seconds, and Rebecca will take. I'm sorry, the waitress will come, and we know that we'll get the. You go first, and then that'll be the.
Because I always need to know what everyone else is eating before I make my decision.
Oh, I see. Right.
I don't know why. I've always been like that.
Yes, and I'm quite easy now. I just have a go-to thing because I can't decide. So I just have a go-to thing wherever we go. I just have that because it saves time. Isn't it funny, though, that you're about to marry someone like that? And I married someone exactly. I mean, I remember when we used to go to these drive-through, we had these chicken places in Australia, and you'd sit there for ages. And then he would literally get to the board with 400,000 people behind him in cars. And he would then go, oh yeah, I wonder what I should have. And I'd just go,
yes.
Serious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same when I take your kids to Taco Bell.
And I normally go back to the first thought I had anyway. I normally consider everything and then I think, no, I'll just have a cheeseburger.
No, that's also him. So we go shopping and I hate shopping. Unless it's a bookshop or stationery, I hate shopping. Like, really. He even likes food shopping. But go figure, right? That to me, people can do that for you now. but he loves it. And you can go to a shopping centre, and my mother's the same, and they'll go and see something in the first shop. You'll do 30 shops with them. They'll come back to that thing, at which point I just want to kill them.
Yes. Yes. Nicole, where can people find you online and all the things that you do?
Okay, so the easiest way is my website is www.writingtribe.com, writing tribe one word, and I'm Nicole at writingtribeoneword.com email, and I'm on Twitter. I'm occasionally on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, and also I have
about TikTok.
I haven't braved TikTok, and I am still resisting the urge to go anywhere near that chat AI thingy.
GT or whatever it's called.
Oh. I know I've had people come on, people who want coaching or ghostwriting, and panicking and going, well, if I write, they're going to take my jobs. And I'm just like, they're not, are they? There's a lot of rubbish content out there that robots can produce. It's going to replace that stuff. I think it's probably good on the top 10 stuff, but it's not ever going to give a human. I mean, we've had this conversation now, and, you know, even the ADD or the ADHD, you know, you're never going to get kind of that human connection and go, oh my God, wow, I've just learned something about that. You're not going to get from it. But I also have the free online writing tribe. It is Facebook. And I know a lot of people don't do Facebook, but if you are on Facebook and you want to join the writing tribe, it's free and they're lovely people.
I'm going to be joining it.
He will be
within seconds of finishing this
excellent
interview.
Excellent. I love that. And I shall, and you know, if you want to have a chat, we can have a chat, because I think it'd be a real shame if you don't finish it. And also, you just kind of feel so great when you do.
That's true.
And he gets a guitar.
And you get a guitar and maybe even a puppy.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, what more incentives can I
get? Please, never mind people being quick in queues. You get a guitar and a puppy.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. That's proper. I mean, you know, and not just any guitar, by the way.
No. A Fender Strat.
Exactly, the master of all masters.
Yeah, well, it's going to be David Gilmour Black. That's the plan.
Beautiful. I used to play the guitar 100 years ago, really, really badly, and I haven't played it for 100 years.
I could do Smelly Cat very badly.
Now, see, Smelly Cat might be amongst my favourite songs. That is, I'm not a Friends follower, but she just cracked me up with that song.
Yeah, Bex does a good one. Look, it's been an absolute pleasure. It really, really has, Nicole. And we really are so grateful for you joining us. We've got so much from it, and I'm sure all our listeners have too.
Well, I've loved it. Thank you so much. And I hope we stay in touch.
Indeed, absolutely. We will. Brilliant. I just love that interview. That was such fun.
It was brilliant, wasn't it? Perfect for 111.
Yep. Yeah. I sound like Miranda Hart. Such fun.
Oh, so she say that? I don't know.
Yeah, she did in the series. Yeah, she did. Yeah, it was a great favourite of mine. Well, that was wonderful. Who have we got next week?
So next week we're talking to two chaps from a independent publisher called Wordsmithery, which I love that name. Makes me think of blacksmiths. And they are Sam Hall and Barry Fentiman Hall. And yeah, they also oversee book festivals in Kent. I don't know much any more than that at the moment. So we're going to talk to them about what they do.
Well, let me read just a little line okay from their website, which says, Wordsmithery is regularly commissioned to devise and deliver community-engaged creative literary activities in Kent.
That sounds really good, doesn't it?
So it does, yeah, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to it. They come across as very interesting chaps.
They are a Medway-based literary arts organisation. Perhaps we should get him to speak to Lewis Hastings.
Medway?
Because he writes about the Medway area.
Oh, does he? I honestly can't remember.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The Angel of Whitehall features very heavily in that area.
I don't remember. Oh, yes, I do remember now. Oh, dear.
Yeah, yeah.
Brain fog, sorry.
Yeah, it's been. This is Sunday afternoon as we record this. It is a bit of brain fog. What have we got coming up this week?
We don't have a book publishing this week.
No,
but we've got one publishing next week. So, yes.
We're off to a book launch at the end of the week.
Yeah, so Lynn LaVersha's Blood Ties, which published a short while ago, not very long ago, but she's having an event, sort of book launch. She's going to give a talk about her series as well in Southwold, and we've been invited along. And guess what we said? We said, yes, please.
We're kid-free. We love the seaside. We love Southwold and any excuse.
Yes,
so,
any excuse.
We're going
to
head there.
And Lynn is a great host.
Yeah. And, well, work-wise, I am still, you know, in my knee-deep in the viscera of the late Roman Empire.
Literally.
I'm into the third of the five books I've been commissioned to do about Roman legionaries, and that's for narration purposes. So I'm in my studio every day. And it's been, I'm really enjoying this one. I just, you know, actually can't wait to get in and do some more.
I know. I can see it.
Yeah.
You've got this eagerness about you.
I know. And that's despite the fact that in book two, three of my favourite characters got bumped off.
Yes, you were distraught.
Yeah, I really was. Well, not least because, you know, the three character voices I love doing and you can't use them again. Fortunately, they do appear as ghosts occasionally, so they have returned. But it has meant that I've had to create some new voices.
Are you telling me there are ghosts in this story? Real ghosts?
Well, they appear in dreams and things like that.
Oh, okay.
yeah, there's a lot of sort of elements in this. These books by Gordon Doherty of every book has a dream foreshadowing basically what happens at the end of each book. There's always a dream. You know, poor Parvo, the lead character who has been promoted through the ranks, always has a dream that foreshadows what
might happen. I like that, though, because sometimes that happens in real life. Sometimes you have a dream.
Absolutely, absolutely. Or his dead father speaks to him or whatever. You know, it's quite complex. But, yeah, having to create new voices and new characters. And, I've really enjoyed it. So that's a chunk of my week. But there's so many other things that we're working on at the same time. So
yes, I am structural editing a self-help guide for students, which I'm absolutely loving the work. I love it. It doesn't feel like work at all. I actually get quite excited when I think I'll do a bit of my student book now.
Yeah. So, thank you for joining us here on the Hobcast Book Show. And we'd like to recommend you to our website. Well, two websites now. www.hobeck.net for all things about our fiction business and all our authors and our audiobooks and all our books there and all the latest news and blogs and all that sort of thing. It's there. And archpub.net is the home of our publishing services arm, which we launched 2 or 3 weeks ago. And it's going great guns. So thank you for your support. If you'd like to contact us, please reach out to us through Twitter, where we're very active as Hobeck Books. And we'd like to hear from you. Any comments on this week's show? But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thanks so much for joining us. And it remains for us to offer you this warm wish for your week ahead. May it be wonderful and also
creative.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.